committee together to order. At 1:35, three members present, Senator Ellis, Senator Passman, and Betty Davis. We have two bills to come before us today. One we heard last week, Senate Bill 96, which is a bill that's been requested by Child Support Agency. And it's my desire to move that bill out of here. So all we have to do is bring the bill back to us and take action on it. We do have enough people to do that. There were no other concerns about the bill given to my office, and neither did I hear from anybody on the committee. I assume that it's proper to ask that we move this bill out of committee, Senate Bill 96, without any changes.
I would move that we bring Senate Bill 96 before the Health and Social Services Committee, and this is under the committee substitute for Senate Bill 96, 26-LS0485/E.
Any objection? Then it would be my intention to say that this bill is moving out of our committee at this time then. We do have a major bill coming before us today, and I'd like to call the prime sponsor of the bill up, Senator French, if you will come forward. This is the health care bill. This bill was heard last year. It's back with some changes, and he's going to give an overview of it, and then he has to go and conduct another meeting. He'll have his staff take over at that time. So the rest of this time will be spent on this bill if necessary. It is not our intention to move this bill out on the first hearing, but we want to at least get some direction on where we need to go. I turn it over to you, Mr. French, Senator
Madam
French.
Chair, and welcome. Thank you for having us in your committee today, members of the committee. My name is Hollis French. I represent Senate District M. And with me is Andy Motoro, who has been working on this bill since its very inception. He is extremely knowledgeable about the bill. I will give you an overview today, hit some of the sort of philosophical high points, if you will, and then leave Mr. Motoro to do a sectional analysis and answer any technical questions you may have about the bill. I guess I just want to begin by saying that there are 123 Alaskans in our state who do not have health insurance. The vast majority of those individuals work for a living. They are just not as lucky as we are to have health insurance provided to them as a job benefit. These working Alaskans simply lack the economic wherewithal to afford an increasingly out-of-reach health insurance policy. This bill is designed to make health insurance affordable for all Alaskans. It keeps the insurance landscape very much in place of the way it exists now, a mix of private and government insurance, and simply makes private insurance affordable to those Alaskans. If you have a health insurance policy now, this changes nothing for you. If you're covered at work, if you're covered through some other government policy, this doesn't change or alter you one bit. You don't have to drop something and sign up for something else. This simply reaches out to those 123,000 Alaskans and makes a private insurance policy affordable for them. Why are we continuing to advance this bill when it looks as if President Obama is going to fix this problem for us from Washington? Madam Chair, there's two reasons. One, I think it'd be foolish to wait for Washington to swoop into the rescue with the other enormous problems that confront our nation. It may be some years, really, before Washington is able to solve this problem. Two, it may very well be that the solution adopted by Washington requires us to show initiative, requires us to adopt our own state plan that comports with a broad federal mandate. So it's important for us to become acquainted and familiar with the basic building blocks of insurance reform so that we are able to stand up on our own two feet and offer an Alaskan solution when the time comes. This bill before you is modeled after the Massachusetts plan, which passed some 2.5 years ago. There are many states pursuing similar models. They're all a little bit different from one another. I don't know if you were here when we heard a presentation from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation on what's happening across the nation, and there's probably more than a dozen states pursuing health insurance reform. But the Massachusetts model has been in effect now for a couple of years. It is at work, and the results there are encouraging. Let me just hit a couple of high notes. They've registered about 100,000 people, new entrants into the insurance market. what's fascinating is that the dire predictions of private insurers dropping or employers dropping their employees from coverage hasn't happened. In fact, the number of people insured by private insurance policies has remained steady. But many, many people have availed themselves of the opportunity to buy an affordable health insurance policy through the Massachusetts Connector, and it's led to a decrease in the number of hospital admissions as people go and get primary care instead of going to an emergency room. And in general, it looks like that program is going to be a success. We have been making efforts in this state to publicize, really, the way this bill works for some time. Mr. Motoro created a website that's had tens of thousands of hits on it. We set up a calculator that lets you type in your annual income, and it in turn tells you, if you answer a few other questions, how much a program would cost if we were to adopt a model like the Massachusetts plan. Over 1,000 individuals have worked through that calculator to give themselves an idea of what the bill would cost. The bill has enjoyed broad support from hospital groups, from doctors, from a variety of nurses, from many of the major components and building blocks of the insurance of the health industry. There is some trepidation, I'll let you know, from the insurance industry itself. There is some trepidation from small business people. I think they fear that there is going to be some hidden tax or some hidden cost associated. Mr. Motoro will explain exactly how small employers contribute. But for many, many, many small employers, there will be no cost whatsoever, and suddenly they will have workers who are covered with an insurance policy that can go get simple, easy primary care when they need it instead of waiting until problems develop much worse. There's probably two technical elements I'll introduce, and then I'll step down from Mr. Motoro. The bill has what's known as an individual mandate. It's fundamentally a requirement that each person go out and get a policy, an affordable policy. The reason for that individual mandate is that insurance works best, as you can well understand, when everyone's in the pool. The more people in the pool, the lower the cost for everyone. The fewer people in the pool, the worse. And we have made the tough policy choice that the individual mandate is the appropriate direction to go, thus requiring every person to get just some, at least minimal form of insurance. We've made special arrangements for young people that don't have the insurance needs that those of us who are middle-aged are, but nevertheless, everyone must acquire some basic form of insurance. The flip side of that, the reciprocation, what you extract from the insurance industry, is a so-called guarantee issue. And that says is that every person that presents themselves must be issued a policy. No more will the insurance industry be able to turn people away because of disqualifying conditions, with some exceptions, obviously. But the idea is that those are two sides of a coin: guarantee issue, individual mandate. The insurance industry will get tens of thousands of healthy new customers into their paying ranks, and in exchange, we will require them to issue policies to those Alaskans who have some difficulty getting insurance. That, Madam Chair, is a broad overview of what is a not too complex, but somewhat lengthy and detailed bill. With that, I will yield what remaining time we have to Mr. Motoro, who will walk you through it, and I'll excuse myself to my committee.
All right, we thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there any question of the sponsor before he goes to his next meeting? Hearing none at this time, we'll allow you to leave.
Either way. Thank you, Chair Davis, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Motoro. I'm staff to Senator French. And if it pleases the committee, I'll just go through the bill section by section, giving you an overview of the technical parts. Happy to answer any questions you have along the way or however you'd like to do that. But feel free to interrupt at any time.
All right, thanks.
To start out, Section 1 of the bill provides some findings. They go over many of the themes that Senator French just presented to the committee. And the real meat of the bill begins on page 2 on line 24. This is the part that establishes the program itself. The first section, 2154-200, outlines in broad brushstrokes the goals that are actually going to be implemented to help fulfill some of the problems mentioned during the findings of the bill. One of these goals is to make insurance affordable for all residents of the state and get everybody covered, as Senator French mentioned. The real structure of what the bill creates, however, begins on page 3, line 9. This is the structure of the healthcare board. This board will be an oversight committee underneath the Department of Insurance, which implements this plan. Division of Insurance, pardon me. It'll have 13 members, and the way this board was structured was to include six individuals who focus more on the business side of healthcare transactions. We have an insurance producer. This is someone who is more in touch with the individual policies as they're issued to the consumers. An insurance representative. This will be more from the business angle. We have two business representatives, one from a large business, one from a small business. And we also have two hospital representatives. This will be more these six individuals. Well, you can't classify one or the other and what they represent. This will be from the more business side of healthcare. Then from the consumer side, we have a representative from a labor organization, two Alaska physicians, a registered nurse, and two consumer advocates. This will be more focused on the patient side of the plan. Then as a 13th member, we have the commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services or their designee. So if the two sides kind of get into a stalemate, then that individual will cast the deciding vote. That's the first section of the bill. The next one, on page 4, line 5, this is 2154-220, outlines the powers and duties of this board. The board has a primary oversight responsibility of the healthcare clearinghouse and the healthcare fund, and we'll go into more details about those later on. One of the important functions that the board does take on, however, on page 4, lines 10 through 15, is they classify plans that are available through the clearinghouse. Part of the goal of this bill, as Senator French mentioned, is to encourage competition and consumer choice. And what this will do is place plans in more of an apples-to-apples comparison for consumers when they go to the clearinghouse to choose a plan. Massachusetts, with their connector, has three different levels of plans. We have gold, silver, and bronze, and these classifications will be based on the fiscal elements of the bill, such as deductibles, copays, coinsurance, out-of-pocket maximums, elements such as that. The board will also recommend essential healthcare services that all plans sold through the clearinghouse should include. These recommendations would be then put in front of a body such as yours, where they could be fleshed out by a committee and discussed for possible implementation. There's the financial criteria of plans itself are not specified by this bill, and this is something that a lot of people have raised concerns about. You know, are we going to force every Alaskan to purchase a $10,000 healthcare plan that has a $100 deductible? And the answer to that is no. The bill does provide a very broad definition of essential healthcare services, but the only direction it provides can be found on page 5, lines 6 through 8, which requires that a healthcare plan issued through the clearinghouse can protect an insured from severe financial hardship caused by the cost of receiving care. We want to maximize consumer choice, not limit it, so long as people don't go bankrupt. We know from studies around the country that most personal bankruptcies include a medical element, and I'd be happy to provide that study to anyone if they'd like to see it in writing. The board will also provide procedures for an annual open season where customers can change their plan choices. This season will reduce a moral hazard of someone buying a high-deductible plan and then deciding once they get into a car accident, which they caused and therefore, you know, must be covered under their plan for, barring any complications on that, from then upgrading to a low-deductible plan. So that's another element that the board will have to provide for. Any questions so far?
You may continue.
And please feel free to tell me to slow down if you need to. Okay. The next section describes the healthcare clearinghouse. This can be found on page 5, line 12. And this clearinghouse, as I discussed briefly a minute ago, will be the place where Alaskans become connected with private healthcare plans that suit their needs. There's two examples of this in existence now. There's the Massachusetts Healthcare Connector, which can be accessed at www.mahealthconnector.org. And if you find a zip code in Massachusetts, you can type it in and see how exactly it works. It's kind of like an Expedia for health insurance plans. So that's a perfect example of what we could do in Alaska. Another example of an electronic clearinghouse type structure is the Federal Employee Health Benefits Plan System, where federal employees go to choose plans that suit their needs. You can see, you know, side by side what plans are available to you and the cost of those plans. That's the clearinghouse. The next section, 2154-240, can be found on page 5, line 22.
Madam Chairman?
Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I did have some other questions. I didn't realize you wanted to take them. You are moving along rather quickly here. But the question would be, Massachusetts had a relatively small population that was not covered by insurance in a relatively small state. How do you anticipate the clearinghouse, if that would be the place that it would emanate from, would get the information out to areas of the state in such remote areas of the state that are not connected by the internet or anything, and not even telephone in most cases, or some cases anyhow?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, it's a great question. It's part of the reason we're leaving the clearinghouse decisions and the structure and the fine print up to the board to help determine, because clearly Alaska has some different factors on the ground that don't necessarily allow internet connectivity everywhere. And that will be something that is not set in stone in this bill.
Okay. And if I may, just an earlier question I had, what is the difference between a licensed insurance producer and somebody who is licensed to transact health care insurance in the state?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, that's a great question. It was actually brought up last year, I believe, in Senator Ellis's committee, and it was brought to us by the insurance industry. I believe a producer is someone who looks and works with individuals on the ground on the specifics of a particular health care plan, and then an insurance representative would be more from the business side aggregate. And I can look behind me and see if I can get confirmation on that.
Close.
Maybe I'll...
Excuse me, who are you trying to get?
Linda Hall. Division of Insurance Director Linda Hall.
Linda, would you like to come up?
For the record, Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. The difference is the first one is an insurance agent. The second is the actual insurance company.
Company. Okay. Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You may continue.
Thank you. Okay, section 2154-240 on page 5, line 22, will create needs-based vouchers, and it also includes the individual responsibility clause, which Senator French has already introduced in concept. These are two pretty major components of the legislation that make it possible. So Section A includes that individual responsibility clause, which outlines that all Alaskans should have meaningful health coverage. 1 through 7 of subsection A outline specific examples of what will qualify to fulfill that end. Individuals who are covered under an employer plan or other publicly funded options, IHS recipients, are considered in compliance with having health coverage. 8 in that is a religious exception, and that allows someone who has deeply held religious beliefs who objects to the overall program to opt out of health coverage altogether. This was brought forward last year during discussions on the bill, and we added that exemption. Massachusetts has a similar one. I'm going a little out of order in this section, but subsection G on page 7, lines 20 through 26, mentions that people who have health coverage under 1 through 7 or elsewhere will not be eligible to receive needs-based vouchers that I'm about to describe to purchase health coverage. The idea being, if you are eligible for Medicaid, that is the place where you get health coverage. You don't have the option to receive money to buy an additional health coverage plan. It should help reduce the fiscal impact of this legislation. Subsections B through E describe the sliding.
Yeah. What is the function on line 26, page 7? Of the one-year minimum requirement?
Line 7. The page 7, line 26. Senator Pasvan, through the chair, the purpose of this legislation was to reduce the impact of people moving to Alaska solely for receiving health coverage, which is made affordable. It's a very similar one that we have to the permanent fund dividend as well, currently in law. That was also an addition that was made to the bill during last session. Okay.
Any further questions?
Mm-hmm. No further questions.
All right. You may continue.
Thank you, Chair Davis. So to begin with the needs-based vouchers and how exactly they will work, we should note that the federal poverty level this year has been set for 13,530, I found out last night. It was recently updated a few weeks ago. For an individual per year, or for a family of four, $27,570 per year. And subsection C on page 6, line 28, provides a guarantee that anyone who falls below that line won't have to pay for the health coverage they receive. And this is, you know, many people who fall below the poverty line are qualified for other publicly funded options like Medicaid or other such programs. Sometimes acid tests disqualify people from those programs. They won't have to pay for health coverage. They might have co-pays and deductibles, again, that fall under the this must protect them from severe financial hardship in the future, but they would not have to pay for the coverage themselves. D sets up the sliding scale vouchers. This is page 7, line 3, and it provides that on a sliding scale, individuals who earn between 100% and 300% will receive vouchers that make insurance affordable to them. The amount of these vouchers will vary depending on the household and how much they earn, with more assistance going to those who earn less. E, on page 7, line 10, requires that all individuals who earn over 300% of the federal poverty level who do not fall under one of those exceptions in A acquire health coverage. They will not necessarily receive, they won't receive needs-based vouchers, but they might receive specified beneficiary vouchers, which are provided for later in the bill. Subsection B on page 6, lines 15, provides larger vouchers to individuals who only qualify for ACHIA coverage because these plans cost more. This is a concern that was brought up to last year to committee, and it was added in. And subsection F ensures that only legal residents of Alaska will receive these needs-based vouchers. And that concludes that that section. Moving along to 2154-250. This is where essential health care services are defined for the legislation. It requires that all health plans sold in the clearinghouse include coverage for certain things, such as preventative and primary care, emergency services, inpatient services and hospital treatment, ambulatory patient services, prescription drug coverage, and mental health services. This is a pretty broad listing of things that a plan must cover, but again, the financial criteria is not specified, and it just depends on that definition of severe financial hardship, which is what the board must determine in outlining financial terms for qualified plans. On page 8, line 7, 2154-260 begins, and this relates to employer coverage and the employer levy. A and B in this section are included to make certain that nothing changes with employer-based plans should an employer want to keep those plans going the way that they are currently set up. C and D on page 8, lines 13, relate to the employer levy. And the rules for this are pretty simple. If you're a small employer who has a payroll of less than $500,000, there is no levy whatsoever required on your payroll. For businesses with a payroll between $500,000 and $1 million annually, there will be a 1% levy. For businesses with a payroll greater than $1 million, there will be a 2% levy. Now, there's multiple ways that this levy is not actually levied against your payroll. And that is, if you're providing an employee with health coverage, you're not required to pay it. The definition of being a providing employer requires that you either offer to pay 33% of a health care premium, or you successfully enroll 25% of your employees. In addition, there's another element in Senate Bill 61, which says that if an employer sets up a Section 125 account, which is a way for employees to purchase health coverage or health services with pre-federal tax dollars, it exempts you altogether from these levies. And last year, in conversation with some insurance producers, we found that the cost of these plans run in the neighborhood of several hundred dollars for all employees for small firms per year.
Could you tell me where that is in the bill?
Where that is in the bill? Certainly. That it will be in subsection D, page 8, line 29.
Thank you.
So that covers the employer responsibilities under the legislation. Again, it's a part of the bill that we'll definitely be hearing comments from. I believe the committee received a letter on that front, and it's an element of the bill. Next, we'll go to 2154-270 on page 9, line 5. And this discusses the structure of insurance plans available in the clearinghouse. A outlines that plans sold in the clearinghouse must meet the requirements of this legislation and those under the insurance statutes in Title 21. This ensures a baseline of quality for plans. You're not going to see the faxes that we occasionally receive in our office offering for $50 a month full medical and health benefits for your family. Those aren't regulated by the insurance title and medical discount programs and such. B mandates that an insurance company not be able to turn down an individual looking for coverage for a plan sold through the clearinghouse. Senator French talked about this element of the bill earlier. This is the guarantee issue portion of the bill. C makes clear, again, that health insurance plans can have financial conditions such as deductibles, copays, and coinsurance that vary. They're not all set in stone for all plans sold through the clearinghouse. D increases the dependent age to 25 years of age, or until 2 years after the dependent no longer resides with the family. This element should keep the cost down for the legislation. E and F are new elements to the legislation this year, and like the guarantee issue provision in the bill, they are made possible by getting everyone into the insurance pool. Both borrow from current small group insurance regulation and statute. E, on page 9, line 25, defines pre-existing condition exclusions that are allowable in plans sold through the healthcare clearinghouse. They're patterned off of the currently applicable small group insurance statutes 2154-110A, and they provide protections to individuals who have employment-based coverage to those in the individual market in plans sold through the clearinghouse. I'll go through one through four individually. E1 requires that insurers consider no more than 2 years of medical history when establishing that a pre-existing condition exists. 2 prohibits the creation of a pre-existing condition only on the grounds of genetic information. 3 prevents these exclusions from extending longer than 12 months, though depending on prior coverage, that may be shortened, and I'll get into that shortly. And 4 prohibits considering pregnancy as a pre-existing condition. Subsection F relates to credible coverage and how that then relates to the pre-existing condition exclusions under E. On page 10, line 5, it requires that any pre-existing condition exclusion is reduced by periods of credible coverage if it is applicable. This language is taken from 2154-110B mostly, although it was modified slightly for the purposes of fitting with this legislation. Page 10, lines 5 through 9 describe plans that count as credible coverage under the bill. And these are essentially any plan that would count as credible coverage under the small group rules, plus any plan sold through the healthcare clearinghouse. It also includes Medicaid recipients and such like individuals like that. And it requires that they reduce the pre-existing condition limitation by any period of credible coverage prior to or post a 90-day exclusion. Let me just start that all over. Page 10, lines 5 through 9 describe plans that count as credible coverage under the bill and requires that a pre-existing condition exclusion must be reduced from the maximum of 12 months, as outlined in E, by the length of continuous credible coverage an individual had before they acquired new coverage through the healthcare clearinghouse. It requires that any type of plan that fulfills the individual mandate under 240 of this legislation will count as credible coverage in addition to plans that fit the definition under 2154-120, and that's the current small group regulation. Page 10, lines 9 through 12 outline what the term continuous means, and again, that's the 90-day break in coverage. Lines 12 through 14 note that a 90-day break in coverage prior to an enrollment date in a plan in the clearinghouse will not be counted as continuous. Lines 14 through 15 allow for waiting periods. If they are applicable for a health plan, the state of Alaska has a waiting period where new employees have to wait until coverage kicks in. That is still allowable despite this new language. And these two subsections, E and F, ensure that people aren't penalized when they switch from one benefit plan to another in the healthcare clearinghouse, whether it be due to a change in their employment, financial situation, or family status. Many other states include similar protections for consumers, and in Alaska, these requirements currently do exist in the small group market. Any questions on that new section?
Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The lines 12 and 13 says this subsection does not apply if an individual's most recent period of creditable coverage ended on a date more than 90 days. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm reading it wrong. I'm concerned about 90 days, and insurance coverage usually runs month to month, mm-hmm. and a 90-day period would start and end or could end in the middle of any particular month. And was there some reason for considering 90 days versus using calendar months or something?
Calendar months. Senator Thomas, through the chair, we patterned this off of the small group regulations or the small group statutes.
Okay.
We did not consider using month. I'd be happy to look into that and get back to you on that.
Well, if it exists, and you've taken it from other mm-hmm. statute anyhow.
Yes, we did that through the chair. And many other states use days as a guideline as well, days or years. And so, but I'd be happy to look into anything you want on that front.
That's okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, next section of the bill, 2154-280 on page 10, line 16, establishes the health care fund and describes the specified beneficiary vouchers. That word always gets me. The health fund will be a separate trust fund of the state, and will include state money and appropriations, any federal dollars. Senator French spoke earlier about potential funding coming in from sources we aren't even aware of yet through the federal government. This bill has an element to capture those funds and use them towards putting the plan forward. The employer levy will be put into this health fund as well, and essentially this fund will be used to pay out the sliding scale vouchers that were discussed earlier in the bill. Subsection B describes another source of funding that can come into the fund, but these will not be used for the needs-based vouchers. These are specified beneficiary vouchers, which gives an employer an option of providing a set number of dollars to their employees to purchase health benefit plans. Last year, we heard testimony from business owners saying they wanted to contribute something to an employee's health benefits, but they couldn't sponsor an entire plan or pay the whole cost. This will give employers an accountable way to give dollars to their employees to use for the purchase of health coverage. 2154-290 on page 11, line 7, discusses disputes and appeals and the process that that can all go through. Page 11, line 16, relates to reporting. It provides for an annual report by the healthcare board that includes statistics relating to how the program is performing. And it also has some other topics that can be discussed and should be discussed annually to be presented to the legislature and other bodies related to electronic health records, SCHIP programs, effective mandated benefits, and everything else on this program. Kind of gives the legislature a way to check up on the successes of the program or places that need to be addressed in future years. And then section 2154-310 relates to regulations, and any regulations will be established under the Administrative Procedure Act. With that overview, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have about the legislation.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The idea of people making contributions to the plan, was that something that came from the Massachusetts plan? They had something similar to like that, because there are contributions made by individuals on behalf of other individuals, and it just mm-hmm. kind of flows through. Is that the way that works?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, I believe Massachusetts does have an element like that. However, last year in testimony, we heard from the owner of Snow City Cafe in Anchorage, who specifically stated her desire to be able to contribute dollars, and she actually does contribute dollars to her employees' health care. This would just be a route by which they can do so.
And if I may, back to page 8, to the 1% and 2% of gross payroll, that money goes to the fund as well, or?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, that is correct. It does not go to the fund to pay out specified beneficiary vouchers, however. It goes to the fund for the sliding scale vouchers, and not to the employees of that employer.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Are there any other questions at this time? We do have people sign up for testimony. And what we will do is go into public testimony at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll start here. Marie Darling. You know what to do, so you can state your name and give us your affiliation, please.
Marie Darling, representing the AARP Capital City Task Force. And you have received a two-page letter, which is a little longer than what we usually do, because in this letter this time, we do say that we really support the work on this bill and are concerned about trying to get something started, at least, to address this problem of those who are without insurance. And our concerns, of course, are those who, of course, don't have any insurance, but also that the fact that access to affordable coverage really is increasingly difficult, maybe as people age, and particularly before they are covered by Medicare. So our concern is that those who are, say, from 50 to 64, and actually that is one of the largest growing group of people that we have right now and that are uninsured, that or even some of those with Medicare then have a problem even finding a physician who will take Medicare. So our concern is that there be some way to address the issues of those who really do not have coverage or don't have or are, say, underinsured for some reasons. But also, we have looked at this from several different angles, but with the idea of the questions that will come up, which we know as you begin working on the bill, and I'm sure in the work that's already been done on it, that they have looked at some of the issues here that we are raising as those things that need to be looked at as this bill is worked on. So I'm not going to go through all of them, but you have them here, the questions that we are asking, and some of which maybe is already taken care of in the bill or hopefully will be later on, so that we will be following it and hopefully see a lot of these things addressed, and then hopefully have something possibly done this year. And as they've said, many people might say, well, why do it when Congress is doing it? But we're concerned that as Senator French said, we don't know how long it's going to take or anything else, that to try and address this as much as we can as a state first, just may be to our benefit.
Thank you for your testimony. I do have some concerns on some of the issues that you have addressed, particularly that age group between 50 and 64, because that means we'll be pushing more people out without the insurance, and we have to come up with the way that we're going to make the coverage for them. The rest of the questions that you have, is my intent to have a subcommittee to look in some of these issues, and we will discuss that and ask for further input from you at a later time.
We'd be glad.
Is there any other questions, comments? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Beverly Smith.
My name is Beverly Smith, and I am the Christian Science Committee on Publication for the State of Alaska. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify regarding SB 61. In my capacity as Christian Science Committee on Publication for Alaska, one of my roles is to ensure that you have accurate information concerning spiritual healing as practiced in Christian Science, so that this cost-effective, reliable, and effective form of care is not overlooked or restricted in the state's health care reform efforts. In this regard, it is important to preserve the choice of Alaskans to pursue spiritual means for the prevention and cure of disease, including Christian Science treatment and care, and this legislation can be an important avenue for doing so. And I'd like to thank the sponsors for including in the bill the opt-out provision that Mr. Motoro spoke to you earlier about when he was analyzing the bill. However, to meet the health care needs of all Alaskan residents, we feel that health care reform legislation should include coverage for spiritual care, similar to state and federal government plans, which currently do so. So to accomplish this, we request that the following amendment be incorporated into such legislation to provide for consideration of spiritual care benefits as follows. And I've given this on the testimony that I've provided you with. In a section called definitions, it said the term essential health care services, as used in section 2154-250, shall be interpreted to include non-medical health care services provided by a religious non-medical provider as defined in Alaska Statute 2107-250-15. And I have stated that definition at the end of my testimony here, which says religious non-medical provider means a person who does not provide medical care, but who provides only religious non-medical treatment or nursing care for an illness or injury. And I've provided an attachment to the testimony that's called Access to Spiritual Care. And it sets forth the explanation for including religious non-medical care in the legislation. And I'd just like to take a look at this for a minute. It's a comprehensive explanation of our recommendations for health care reform legislation. And to give a better understanding, I'd like to just read a couple of paragraphs there and talk about some of the recommendations. First paragraph, as the Alaska legislature considers health care reform, it is important that any new framework includes spiritual care. Prayer-based healing has been a mainstay in American life for years. Despite the progress in medical science, many Americans continue to rely on prayer as their primary means of health care for one simple reason. They trust its effectiveness, its completeness, and its reliability. For millions of other Americans, the issue at hand is, in some ways, more fundamental, having the option to choose the method of health care that is most effective for them. And the third paragraph, Christian Science is a method of spiritual care that is available to everyone. For over a century, individuals from many different faith traditions have found Christian Science to be reliable and effective in addressing the challenges posed by injury, illness, and disease. For this reason, they will often choose religious non-medical health care in lieu of medical care. The practice of Christian Science includes assistance from Christian Science practitioners, individuals who have been recognized as having demonstrated the ability to help others achieve healing through prayer, as well as from Christian Science nurses, individuals who provide physical assistance for the patient's daily needs while the patient prays for healing. And we've identified two areas where statutory provisions may be needed to achieve public access to spiritual care. And the first, recommendation number one, provides examples of religious non-medical care addressed in various government and private insurance plans. And if you note on the second page, the last bullet under recommendation one talks about Premira, which is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, that covers treatment by Christian Science practitioners. And I've cited that in the benefits booklet. And the recommendation number two, Alaska is already on the record as accommodating religious non-medical care in managed care insurance plans. So we really don't have to deal with that here. So I'm happy to work with lawmakers to make sure language is included so that insurance coverage is provided for those Alaskans choosing spiritual care to meet their spiritual needs, to meet their health care needs. This care is reliable and effective, and if people are achieving complete healing through spiritual care without incurring large medical bills, then society is benefited. We applaud you for your efforts in bringing solutions to the healthcare challenges in Alaska. We appreciate the desire to make humanity safer and healthier. We respectfully request that the inclusion of religious non-medical healthcare as a covered benefit be expressed clearly within SB 61. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patty, I'm not sure if this is Bali.
Yes, Bowley.
Bali? Okay.
Yeah, I just came down from the top of Gold Street, so I was a little out of breath when I was putting my name down.
All right.
I'm Patty Boyle, or Patricia A. Boyle. I'm from Homer. I'm coincidentally in Juneau for my son's birthday. And I'm honored to be here in front of you. I have testified through the LIO before. And if I was still in Homer, you'd be hearing me on the phone if you're taking telephonic. I'm not super prepared for this because it was just a last minute thing of like, oh, I'm going to run down and do this. I've worked in healthcare for more than 25 years. I'm a certified coding specialist for physician-based offices. I've done insurance billing. I am currently uninsured. I haven't been insured since June of 2008. Prior to that, I had a CHIA. I couldn't afford it. It was too expensive. It was like $10,000 a year plus 20%. Too much of a big bite out of my budget. I myself am in favor of a universal single-payer system, but I don't see that happening really soon, and I think it's time for the state of Alaska to do something. There are too many uninsured people, and it's cost-shifting. The people who are uninsured cannot pay their bills, and so either it's bankruptcy or they go through the poverty programs at the hospitals. I'll tell you just this one little story that has affected our family. Our son, who is now 28 years old, last year had to have urgent open-heart surgery. And this is a child who had no history of heart problems. This is also a child who's been around doctors his whole life. His father built his delivering doctor's house. I worked for doctors. Nobody picked up that he had a heart problem until all of a sudden, boom, just like that. Well, you know, Alaska Medicaid doesn't have anything for single adults that don't have dependent children. We were able to get him preemptively disabled by Social Security, which made him eligible for Medicaid, who then did pick up all his bills. Now he is no longer disabled because he had his surgery, so he no longer has Social Security, so he no longer has Medicaid. He still needs to have an $1,800 echocardiogram. He has no money for that. And now he is uninsurable. He could not go get private insurance. Nobody is going to touch a young man who's had open heart surgery. And I don't think even a 2-year waiting list is going to get Blue Cross to say, oh, sure, Tris, we'll insure you. So I think that we are at the point where Alaska cannot wait. And I think that if we look nationally, we're seeing people who are losing their jobs are also losing their insurance. Alaska so far has been kind of buffeted from that, but I think it is going to happen. I think that a lot of your employers are going to find they can no longer afford insurance, and they don't feel compelled anymore. There seems to be this, it's not a community issue anymore. Employers don't feel obligated to supply those benefits to their employees. It's kind of like, well, if you don't want the job, somebody else does. And so I encourage you to get this out of committee this year and at least get the ball rolling, because if I were to have something catastrophic happen to me, I don't know what I'd do. And like I said, my son is no longer insurable. So I encourage you to support this bill, and I'm really hoping that we go for a single-payer system, because I think that we're losing a lot of money just by having all these different fingers in the pie. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? I hear no questions. I just want to say I appreciate your comments, and I know that we do need to move forward here at the state level. That's why we have this bill before us again. But also, we do need the federal government to help us out. And that one issue that you addressed about your son is something that's probably going to be picked up with by the federal government fairly early that would assist us in what we're doing, trying to do in this bill also.
You mean as far as giving him insurance?
Yes, to have coverage for him, and also for people that can't afford the insurance that you had to drop because of that. They're discussing those issues, and there might be some help coming.
Well, I sure
in that direction.
Because I'm not alone in this.
Oh, no, there's others.
Senator French said 123,000 yes.
Uninsured or underinsured, yes. Yeah. Okay, let's see what we have off-site here. Oh, I thought I had a list. A name or two. Is there about anybody at any of the LIOs? Maybe this, that's the last bill. Maybe this is it. These were for 96. Is there anybody else here to testify on 61 in the audience? Is there anyone online that's to testify on 61? Hear none. That completes the list of testimonies, as far as I can tell. Nobody's speaking up, and there's nobody else here in the audience. What's the wishes of the committee? At this time, we can continue to discuss the bill if you have some things that you want to put on record at this time. Or we can say that this bill is coming back before us. But what I want to hear from the committee is if there's anybody here willing to work on a subcommittee to look at some of the issues that came before us today and other areas that we might want to address before this bill come back to my committee. And if you don't volunteer, the chair will be volunteering somebody. And the one person that I'm looking at is one of the prime sponsors of this bill, at least a co-sponsor of this bill. And I know he's a busy person, but I think that he could probably help out in that. And I'm speaking of Senator Ellis. Want to make a comment? Say
well,
yes or no?
I'm a proud co-sponsor of the bill. I'm comfortable with the bill as it is. I've heard the presentation four or five times, and I continue to be a strong supporter of moving forward.
I'm sure that you are a strong supporter of it, but there have been some issues that has to be addressed by this committee before this bill can be moved. And even though you might be supportive of it, you might help us to come up with the solutions that we need to bring back forward. There's one person that's missing from the committee, and I don't know what his plans would be, but I would like for you to serve on the committee, and we won't have a lot of meetings. If you would consent to that, I could
sure,
ask someone else to help.
I'd be happy to serve on a subcommittee.
All right, thank you.
I would serve with Senator Ellis.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Yes, Senator Thomas?
I was going to ask a question. I wasn't going to volunteer.
we'll take those two volunteers, and along with their staff and my staff, I think we have enough.
I think so.
To make it work. Thank you very much.
All those bright minds, I think so. May I ask, I'm not sure if you're going to have...
You may ask your question.
Well, there were a couple, actually. One was what, if any, penalty there is for not purchasing insurance or making yourself available to do it, because there are some areas where folks are required to pay. It says shall pay for the premium for health care insurance for essential health care services at a minimum. And I was just curious, because I did not, at least in the overview, find what the penalty is for this, what we're going to do to people, and also, that's the main question, I guess.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, it's a great question. It is not something specified in this bill. Senator French has said on the record he does not anticipate throwing people in jail for not having health coverage. It's something that isn't specified and left into the regulations at this point.
And another, if I may, do you anticipate that as we get more people in the system, that will encourage, you know, because there are a lot of doctors around that do not take Medicaid. Do you assume that the increase in eligible participants in health care plans will increase the number of providers? Is that a natural? Is that what's taken place in other places, other states that have increased their roles, their numbers?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, interestingly enough, Massachusetts had some experiences following the implementation of their plan, and the time it took to get in to see a primary care doctor actually got longer after their plan increased. This was partially caused by the fact that there were new customers able to afford primary care for the first time. On many fronts, Health Affairs had a great article last year which discussed the percentage of people who skip needed care because of the cost of receiving it. And they were cut by, you know, half or a third to what they used to be as a result of the legislation going in. I think it underlines the importance of considering supply-side medical needs with legislation such as this.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Here, no other questions at this time. We will pass all the information along to the subcommittee. We will be getting back to you as sponsor of the bill to see when we could have our first meeting on that. I don't have anything else to come before us today. Unless there's somebody in the audience out there to have some comment to be made, I'm well ready to close out this meeting for today. It is now 2:30, and the Senate Health Committee is